That is about the way in every one of these regions that we have done these things. The people have fell. Then we came home and came our depression. You may have heard of it. It hit a good many American towns. I hope it didn't come to North Carolina, but it went nearly everywhere. And among those that were the hardest hit were the soft coal miners. There were about 500,000 soft coal miners out of work. In West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, and southern Indiana, western Pennsylvania. And Mr. Hoover, who was president then, told us he had $450,000 that could be used, and that he'd start us with that if we'd undertake the care of these soft coal miners. We organized it just about the way we organized the child feeding in Germany. We went into these regions and organized the feeding in all the schools where the coal miners lived. We took care of their families. And then we saw that it was hopeless to expect to do a permanent piece of work by just feeding children and mothers. And so we had the happy idea of buying land and putting the miners on small farms in a community so organized that there would be supplementary means for their livelihood. And so we built a number of communities, started them building their houses, worked out a plan for house building, worked out a plan for furniture making in the village in the winter. In another community, we had a knitting machine, a factory for knitting sweaters, and then we organized the sale of the furniture and the things they made, and we had made a very striking success of these communities. Mrs. Roosevelt, I'm so much of a Republican that I sometimes slip up on the name. Mrs. Roosevelt has taken a tremendous interest in not only this work, but in most other lines of our work. And as you probably know, she has given her radio money and many other contributions to help carry on this work, especially the work among the rehabilitated coal miners. Well, then came the Spanish War, one of the most horrible of all known civil wars, with terrific hate and destruction, and as usual, the people that suffered first and most were always children. We insisted that if we were going to help, we should help both sides, that we should never just go in on one side and help. We pay no attention to races or divisions of people or religious scruples. We go where there's suffering, and we don't ask what church they belong to or which side they're on. And so we got permission from Franco to come in and take care of the children on his side of the battle lines, and we told him that we were also going to be working on the other side. And we had units on both sides of the lines, and American people raised $2 or $3 million for this task. And we carried through the relief of the Spanish children. And then when Barcelona fell, 500,000 people fled into France. taking their children with them. We went right on with these refugees and organized camps in France, taking care of these refugees, especially feeding the children. And we were there when the great collapse of France took place. And some 7 million people came fleeing in front of the armies down into the south of France. And we started the impossible task of trying to help organize and feed the refugees. And we've been there ever since. And every day we are feeding 85,000 children in the south of France. We buy the milk. We use powdered milk entirely, of course. We buy the powdered milk in Switzerland, and we buy the rice in Egypt, and we buy the vegetables in North Africa, and we do feeding entirely in schools or in camps, and to children and to babies. 10,000 babies are being fed. And just as this crisis came, somebody up in the University of Rochester invented a method of producing concentrated vitamins. And we send over a 5-gallon can of vitamins, and it makes 1 million doses, as good as a large dose of cod liver oil for the life of a child. We send the vitamins by the clippers, when there is a clipper, and when there's somebody going that can take it. And our main problem is not getting money, but getting permission to spend our money when we have it. Because you can't spend any money in Europe without permission of the Treasury Department. And when we have a chance to buy 650 tons of milk, as we did the other day, it takes more than a month to get permission to buy it. And part of the money we have to use is French money frozen in a New York bank. And all you have to do is move it from one refrigerator to another. But even that, it takes weeks to accomplish. Well, on the day of broken glass, which is the 10th day of November, the day of broken glass is the day when every Jewish shop had the windows broken. Every synagogue was set on fire in Germany. 35,000 Jews were taken that day to concentration camps. And we immediately went to Washington and asked the ambassador if he would let us send over relief to the Jews that were in war, because all the free feeding places were destroyed for poor Jews. Well, we waited 10 days and got no answer. And three of us then got on an ocean steamer and started for Germany to see if we'd get permission over there. And on the steamer was Stanley Jones. And I got a poem from him that Josephus Daniel quoted tonight in an earlier meeting, but the one I got was very different. I'm going to give you my version, and you see how different it is. De Valera, with his green shirt and his back against the wall, Mussolini with his black shirts riding for a fall, Hitler with his brown shirts lording over all, hurrah for Gandhi with no shirt at all. Well, we felt that was quite a lead, and you'll see how it applies in a minute. Well, we spent two weeks trying to get at somebody who had authority to let us take care of suffering German Jews. And everybody told us there was only one place where it could be done, and that was in the Gestapo, secret police. And we had to get it from the heads of the secret police. Well, how do you get in to the secret police? Of course, you know one way to get in, but we didn't like that way. Well, people said the way you got in was to telephone to the top of the Gestapo and say you had a very important matter. So we got a lot of people who had reputation to telephone in for us. And no result ever came. And they'd give it up and we'd go and try somebody else. So I went in one morning to the office of the American Consul General, Raymond Geist, and I said, I'm going back to America and tell the Americans that the American Consul General in Germany isn't any good at all if he can't get us into the Gestapo. Well, he said, all right, I'll do it. So he took up his telephone, and I laughed under my breath, see him maneuver his telephone, and he tried four or five places, and nothing came of it, and he put it down like that and said something, and he said, wait, and he rushed out of the room, and in about 25 minutes, a man came rushing in the door and said, you're wanted instantly. So we three jumped into a taxi cab and drove to an enormous building as big as Windsor Castle. And when we got out, six soldiers came out with helmets on and brown shirts and muskets and got each side of us Quakers. And we three Quakers with these six soldiers marched up, and one of them hit the door with his musket, and the door opened, and we three Quakers went in. And a man came up and gave us tickets and said, you don't have to have a ticket to get in here, but you have to have one to get out, and you better hold on to that. So we kept fingering our tickets, and we were taken through eight great corridors, each corridor opening out into a square inside the building. And then we went up five flights, and then we were at the top of the Gestapo, and there was Mr. Geist, and he said, I've done it. I've got an appointment with the heads of the Gestapo for you, and it can last all day, and you have the job of convincing. And there we three men sat down at the table with two Gestapo chiefs, the other side of us. And what did you do next? Except sit and look at them. Well, we did more than that. We started appealing to them. And we spent two or three hours trying to convince them. They ought to let us investigate their condition and bring relief. And the chief said, we're going out now and have a consultation, and we shall be gone 25 minutes, and when we come back, we'll give you our answer. They went out, and you can guess what we did, what any Quaker would do. We folded our arms and bowed our heads, sat in absolute silence, kind of a meeting for worship. Well, it turned out to be the best thing we could have done. In 25 minutes, they came back, and the chief said, everything you asked for is granted. And I naturally said, it would be a great relief to have it in writing. He said, nobody's ever had any writing from the Gestapo, and I said, then how do we know we've got what you say we've got? He said, every word that's been spoken in this room has been taken down by a mechanism. And we were very glad we bowed our heads. and said anything was wrong. I shall telegraph tonight, he said, to every police station in Germany that the Quakers are given full permission to investigate the sufferings of Jews in Germany and to bring any relief they think necessary. And we jumped on the steamer and came home and organized a relief commission that went over and took charge of it. Helped vast numbers to come out, and then we organized centers of training for citizenship and language in different parts of America, one in Cuba first, one in Hoover's old town in Iowa, one in Richmond, Indiana, and one at Haverford, and two or three in New Hampshire in the summer, where we've taken large numbers of refugees and taught them English, American English, and American citizenship and American history. And we've succeeded in placing nearly all we've had. Been one of the most interesting jobs we've ever undertaken. I'm very glad Mr. Daniels has told you about our work in Mexico. It's been one of the most touching things we've done. I think especially, perhaps, to go down and rebuild the towns that were destroyed by the earthquake last April. The tender feeling that has grown up between us and Mexico has touched our hearts very deeply, and now we are organizing this extensive job of going down and fighting malaria in one of the important areas of Mexico. I mustn't continue, but I want to tell you a story that happened in England. The English Quakers have taken open land around each one of the big English cities and divided this land up into allotments, and they have put the unemployed men on these allotments in the summer to raise their own vegetables and to help finance their lives. And one of these unemployed men got a very poor piece of ground in the distribution, and he was very much impressed with the impossibility of doing anything, but he pulverized it and fertilized it and worked it over all summer, and he got a magnificent crop. And the curate came down at the end of the season, and he said, "Isn't it wonderful what you and God have done with that poor piece of ground?" He said, "Yes, but you ought to have seen it when God had it all to himself." Well, I keep thinking about that every summer, because I have all my life been a farmer, and I raise a great many potatoes. And some of you may know what you have to do. You have to plant them first, and then you have to fight a vast number of weeds, so many kinds I can't tell you about them. And then comes a crop of Colorado beetle potato bugs. And every week you've got to fight that. And when you get that done, then you are pretty sure to have rust. An invisible thing come and attack your potatoes, and that ends the whole thing. And you have to fight that. Well, you fight it all through the summer, and then in the autumn you roll out these great big main potatoes, and you say, "Just see what God and I have done." And the oddest thing about it all is you can't have any potatoes if you don't go there yourself and help God raise them. Leave your field alone and there won't be any potatoes. Well, it illustrates what I've been saying this evening. Here are the towns. Here are the immense things. And God won't do it if we don't help him. If it isn't the human hand and the human lip and the human heart that touches and helps bear this burden, it won't get done. The greatest task that has ever confronted the world will confront us soon. I hope soon. When this war is over. And something of what I've been telling you tonight will confront us all. Can't be done by a little group of Quakers. There are only 100,000 of us in the whole of America. Can't be done by Quakers. But perhaps this thing I've been telling you tonight may be a way in which America can lend hands to God to bind wounds, build a world, and make a new civilization better than this one we've been watching.